This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran says it's closely monitoring U.S. moves and will directly respond to any aggression. This after the Pentagon said one of its major aircraft carriers will remain in the Persian Gulf. Muslims in Nigeria mark the first anniversary of the U.S. assassination of top Iranian and Iraqi commanders. We'll have a report. French protesters again hit the streets of the capital, Paris, to express their anger at police violence and a recent security law. Bomb after his majesty, welcome. Now, we got response from Iran. The country is saying it's carefully monitoring U.S. moves in the Persian Gulf amid the presence of an American aircraft carrier in the region.
So very cautiously and carefully we're watching global developments. Like I've said repeatedly in the past few days, Dr. Zarif also has tweeted the same thing. So specifically, we can see the role of the Asians and allies of the Quds occupying regime in creating certain tensions, especially in Iraq.
Khatibzadeh says that Tehran is seeking no tensions with any country, but it has no hesitation in defending its rights. The spokesman said that Tehran has notified its Persian Gulf neighbors not to fall into U.S. traps. The reaction came after the Pentagon said aircraft carrier U.S.'s Nimitz and its strike group will remain in the Persian Gulf, citing alleged threats from Iran. The announcement is a reversal of an order by acting Pentagon Chief Christopher Miller on New Year's Eve that a Nimitz is being pulled out of the region. Tensions between the U.S. and Iran have been on the rise since Trump ordered the assassination of General Soleimani last year. Iran has rejected any conflict with the U.S., but pledged to avenge the killing. David Yagubian, a California State University professor, says that domestic politics is the reason that the current U.S. administration keeps repeating threats from Iran before President Trump's exit from the White House.
The sinister interpretation would be that the Trump administration is trying to set up for a false flag attack in which there would definitely be a massive loss of life on the Nimitz if this emerged into an open conflict in the Gulf. And so the benign interpretation would just be simply that Trump and Pompeo on their way out are simply wanting to maintain support amongst their domestic base, with both of them continually politicking and interested in potentially future presidential runs, and so not wanting to see as being either de-escalating or taking orders, if you will, from the military or the acting Secretary of Defense, that they're going to show, you know, American strength and keep the Nimitz where it is. But I just do not believe that in terms of, say, naval planning and actual preparation for a real conflict with Iran, that this would be sound at all. And so hence why there are definitely different ways to interpret this.
The Iranian foreign ministry says that a Daesh terror group has been the only beneficiary of the U.S. assassination of General Soleimani. Mohammad Javad Zarif made that comment on his Twitter page, and he said that Daesh has increased its activity since the top Iranian general was killed by the U.S. last January. Zarif said that Soleimani was the main enemy of extremist terrorists. The top general was cowardly assassinated by what he called the terrorist-in-chief. People in Iraq have held a ceremony in the city of Najaf to mark the first anniversary of the U.S. assassination of General Soleimani and Iraqi Commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. Now, this is a day after a mass rally in the capital, Baghdad, where people called for revenge for the two commanders. The demonstrators also demanded the expulsion of American forces from their country. Anti-U.S. sentiment has been on the rise in Iraq and in the region since the Baghdad drone strike last January, which was ordered by U.S. President Donald Trump. The event was also commemorated in recent days across Iran, in Syria, Lebanon, Yemen, and elsewhere. Also, members of the Islamic movement in Nigeria have marked the first anniversary of the assassination of General Soleimani and his Iraqi comrade, Danjuma Abdullahi, has a report.
The Islamic movement in Nigeria held a ceremony attended by many of its members to commemorate General Qasem Soleimani. The theme of the event echoed the organization's earlier statement that the world cannot forget the martyrdom of the Iranian general. The Islamic movement described the U.S. assassination of General Soleimani as a war crime, adding that those who carried out the murder must be held to account.
It's very important as an international figure who was able to stop the capture of Syria from the forces of ISIS and Daesh. He was also able to empower the Islamic resistance, the Palestinian Islamic resistance against the Israel. He is also able to stop the advancement of ISIS in Iraq.
Various speakers at the lecture described late General Soleimani as a strong defender of the Palestinian resistance who took a stand against the Zionist occupation forces. They said General Soleimani played an important role in the liberation of the Syrian city of Aleppo and eliminating Daesh terrorists. The speakers described General Soleimani as a champion of interreligious harmony who will be missed.
We feel that we are together with the principles on which General Qasem Soleimani died. And that is the principle of justice, the principle of preventing, trying to establish justice on the face of the earth, and also the principle of trying to prevent oppression and tyranny.
The lecturer said the martyrdom of General Soleimani and his ally, deputy head of Iraqi Popular Mobilization Units, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, has added a glorious chapter in the history of self-sacrifice. The Islamic movement in Nigeria said General Qasem Soleimani was a man of God and a hero of Islam who succeeded in confronting and defeating enemies of Islam. They said Qasem Soleimani contributed in saving millions of innocent lives and protecting the holy shrines, thereby bringing honor, dignity, and pride to the Muslim Ummah. Danjuma Abdullahi, Kano.
Okay, let's get going. The second part is bulletin, taking a look at it. Europe. In Paris, a protest rally has taken place against police violence and the global security law. Demonstrators want the government to forbid the controversial method of a knee-on-neck choke. Our correspondent has the story.
A compact group of demonstrators took the street again in Paris to protest against police violence, and in particular against the impunity of police officers who used the very controversial method of knee-to-neck choke with fatal consequences. 1 year ago, Cédric Chouviat died after 22 seconds of knee-to-neck choke that caused him fatal wounds. He died in a hospital 2 days later. Four police officers were directly involved and indicted for involuntary homicide. The family of the victim asked for their suspension.
We have asked the Interior Minister to suspend the four police officers involved in the death and the murder of my father. We have been waiting for the suspension for 1 year now. There is no progress at all. We are waiting for a reaction, a real one.
Assa Traore is the sister of Adama Traore, murdered also by the knee-on-neck choke, the same method that killed George Floyd. That led to a worldwide protest asking the ban on such dangerous techniques.
That technique of immobilization used by police forces must be forbidden. That technique is fatal. We have denounced that method for 4 years now because Adam Traoré died exactly the same way as Cédric Chauviat, with a knee on his neck. Both said their last words, "I can't breathe." If French authorities had listened to us, Cédric Chauviat would not have died.
This protest is not only against police violence, but also against the global security law that would facilitate police violence, or at least would make it more difficult to film police violence. It's thanks to video footage that the beating of a music producer in Paris by police officers last November was made public.
Abnormal things are happening in this country from the police side. The government is obliged to react because there is an important mobilization, especially from the youth, against the global security law. It's important to withdraw that law.
The march ended under the Eiffel Tower, the place where Cédric Chauviat was choked to death. Cédric Chauviat died with a knee on neck choke. As long as this method will not be forbidden by the French government, the impunity of police officers will continue. Chris Den Hont, Paris.
The UK government has come under pressure to explain why a series of air raids in Yemen have not been recorded in its confidential log of breaches of international humanitarian law. The Saudi airstrikes led to civilian casualties, so London is accused of not recording the attack, so it could continue with its arms export to Riyadh for use in Yemen. As of last July, the British government recorded 500 possible breaches in Yemen, but parliamentary questions have established that a number of air raids and possible breach of international humanitarian law have not been included. Human rights groups have also said that the true number of breaches should be much higher. The UK has supplied $7 billion worth of weapons to the kingdom since the start of the war on the Saudi neighbor in 2015. Political commentator Colin Cavell says that the United Kingdom is one of the biggest financial and military contributors to the Saudi war on Yemen.
Since this international invasion of Yemen started in March of 2015, we're heading into the sixth year now. Since that time, over 127,000 people have been killed in Yemen, and mostly by these Saudi airstrikes. Where do they get their weapons from? Primarily from the United Kingdom and the United States. The United Kingdom itself has funded Saudi Arabia with over $7 billion worth of bombs and other military equipment to wage this illegal war on the people of Yemen. And yes, they do keep track as an imperialist power on the number of airstrikes that are going on in Yemen, but the only reason that these 500 breaches came to the light of the public is because of a lawsuit by humanitarian groups, and they found out that the UK Ministry of Defense is keeping track not only of the airstrikes, but of the breaches.
The Saudi-led coalition continues its violation of international humanitarian law against Yemeni prisoners. In 2020, more than 20 of those prisoners lost their lives under torture. Correspondent Sana has the details.
New crimes are added to the Saudi-led coalition's record violations of international law following the death of 22 Yemeni prisoners and the coalition's prisons in 2020, all due to torture and medical neglect.
Torture has become a regular thing for the Saudi coalition, and unfortunately, these crimes are being frequent and vary from year to year. This year, 22 prisoners were killed either under torture or medical and food neglect. So we believe that there is an intention to get rid of the prisoners.
The head of Yemen's National Committee for Prisoners Affairs confirms that the UAE keeps hundreds of prisoners in its presence in southern Yemen, despite its refusal to attend any negotiations, while the United Nations has promised to attend amid the humanitarian nature of the prisoners' issue.
The Emiratis are an essential part of this aggression, and they are on the ground, and they have dozens of prisons in the lands they occupied here and in the Horn of Africa. We have asked the United Nations to bring the Emiratis for negotiations, but so far there is no response from them, and we are still waiting.
2020 witnessed remarkable progress in the liberation of 1,087 prisoners of the Yemeni army and the popular committees, 670 of whom were freed through UN mediation and the rest through local exchange deals.
The Saudi coalition's violations of international humanitarian laws are not only against the prisoners, but against the entire people of Yemen, who are the victims of an ongoing war on their country. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Now, all 10 living former U.S. Secretaries of Defense have urged the military not to play any role in President Trump's efforts to block the transfer of power to President-elect Joe Biden. In an opinion piece published in the Washington Post, the group said that the time has come to accept that the Republican president has lost the November vote and that Biden would succeed him on January the 20th. The group includes Mark Esper, who was fired by Trump in November, another Trump defense chief, James Mattis, Robert Gates, Dick Cheney, and Donald Rumsfeld. They warned the Pentagon that efforts to involve the U.S. armed forces in resolving election disputes would take America into dangerous, unlawful, and unconstitutional territory. Trump has rejected the vote results, arguing that there was massive fraud. Now, in the meantime, a leaked phone conversation reveals that a U.S. president has pressed the Georgia Secretary of State to overturn the 2020 presidential election results.
What they did, and you're not reporting it, that's a criminal offense. And you know, you can't let that happen. That's a big risk to you and to Ryan, your lawyers. That's a big risk. But they are shredding ballots, in my opinion, based on what I've heard, and they are removing machinery, and they're moving it as fast as they can, both of which are criminal fines, and you can't let it happen, and you are letting it happen. You know, I mean, I'm notifying you that you're letting it happen. So, look, all I want to do is this. I just want to find 11,780 votes, which is one more than we have, because we won the state.
The hour-long phone conversation between Trump and Brad Raffensperger was obtained by Washington Post. In the audio, Trump stresses claims of voter fraud and irregularities in the U.S. state, which were repeatedly rejected by the Republican state official. His claims come as President-elect Joe Biden's victory in the state has already been certified by the Electoral College. The revelation comes days ahead of the Congress's January 6th meeting, when Biden's victory is expected to be officially certified. Some 100 lawmakers are set to contest the certification, try to change the results in favor of Trump. Political commentator Jason Andruha says that a U.S. president's push for Georgia's officials to overturn the presidential election results in his favor could be seen as a violation of the election interference law.
It's really ironic that Trump would actually accuse someone else of removing machines when it was he that ordered the removal of sorting machines from post offices, had mailboxes torn out of the ground in order to undermine the ability of anyone to use mail-in voting, which would overwhelmingly be Democrats. Now, the fact is, a multitude of accusations have been brought forward about the election being stolen, none of which have borne any fruit whatsoever. There's been tremendous accusations about the Dominion voting system being linked to Venezuela, which is a complete falsehood. In fact, the Dominion voting system offices are both in Canada and the United States, and essentially doesn't have anything to do with Venezuela whatsoever. This is a president that is trying desperately to hang on to his office because he knows that once he leaves, he's probably going to be criminally prosecuted for the crimes that he has committed, which would actually be a change for once for a president to actually face justice for the crimes that they've carried out. I mean, every president is guilty of tremendous crimes, not just against the American people, but against people across the world.
We are with you. What about you? Thankful Moments with IRIB English Radio. From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Closer, Iran.
Hello. I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Hot, and this is the cold water tap. Oh, thank God. You know, my bathroom plumbing was out of service today, and I just had it repaired. In the past, I mean, very long time ago, when most Iranian homes didn't have a bath, there was a public bathhouse in every quarter of the city, which was called Garmabe, meaning a place where there is warm water. Most of such old bathhouses are architectural masterpieces. Today I'm going to visit one of these old bathhouses, to Nawab Bathhouse. Nawab Bathhouse is located in one of the oldest districts of Tehran, in Ray Street. Nawab Bathhouse has been restructured and repaired several times. This bathhouse welcomes the tourists who are interested in the old historical texture of the city of Tehran. Nawab Bathhouse is one of the monuments remained from the Qajarid era. During the Qajarid era, Tehran used to have 182 bathhouses, which most of them no longer exist. People in the past, whether in Iran or other parts of the world, used to hang out in bazaars, bathhouses, or coffee houses. These places used to be a point for social, cultural, and economic interactions. And that's why the architecture of these places were paid special attention to. The architecture of Nawab Bathhouse has really beautiful tile work and drawings. I am passing through the winding alleys of Ray Street. I'm looking for Beik Damghani Alley. Aha! I found it. Here it is. Okay, and this is the building I was looking for. An old but very attractive brick building. On top of the entrance, there is a beautiful tile work which has a writing on it which reads, "The Nawab Bathhouse." I have to go down a few stairs. In the past, bathhouses were built on a floor that was lower than the earth's level, so that the heat in the bathhouse would be kept and water sources like canals and springs would be used in an optimal way. I am now at the vestibule of Nabob Bathhouse. Vestibule, or as we call it in Persian, Hashti, is a covered atmosphere which connects the entrance gate to the bathhouse. Oh, what a magnificent ceiling! This is a dome-like ceiling which its bricks are arranged in a charming way. And here I am at Sarbine of Nabob Bathhouse. Sarbine is the bathhouse's changing room. Just around the room, there are wooden lockers in which people can keep their stuff. Oh well, here is Garmkhane, a place people used to make the water hot. This place is adorned with big turquoise-colored tiles, as well as a line of navy blue tiles. To reach the main bath, I have to go down a few stairs. Oh, wow! This is really beautiful. There is a pool in the middle. It's a big pool with cold water inside, which people used to float in so that they got cool. You know, bathhouses of those times were really hot, and the presence of such cool water pool would be more enjoyable. Well, now let's go to the bathhouse's roof. I am now at the roof of the bathhouse. What I'm seeing is incredible. There are several brick domes here. On some of the smaller domes, there are colorful glasses. These glasses supply the light of the bathhouse and have created a pretty and colorful atmosphere for the bathhouse. The splendor of the Nabob bathhouse is indescribable. Visit this historical place to see its beauties from a closer view. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
that debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, January 3rd marks the first anniversary of the U.S.'s terrorist assassination of Iran's General Qasem Soleimani and Iraqi Commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, along with their companions. These were the ultimate anti-terror commanders in the world. They fought against those terrorists who were threatening humanity with beheadings, crucifixions, and killings in mass. General Soleimani devised the military strategy which caused their defeat in the region. So why did the U.S. kill them, and why hasn't the United Nations made Washington pay for its crime?
Iran's anti-terrorism icon was assassinated by the United States military in the Iraqi capital Baghdad on January the 3rd. Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani was the highest-ranking commander of the Quds Force of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. Soleimani played a key role in strengthening resistance movements across the region. The commander took part in different battlefields to lead resistance fighters. A quiet, charismatic man, a strategic genius, and a tactical operator who spent most of his life in combat. Soleimani first set foot on a battlefield in the 1980s when the newly founded Islamic Republic of Iran came under attack by former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein. Soleimani was at the time a young man in his 20s fighting tirelessly to defend Iranian soil against the aggressor. After 8 years of war, Soleimani emerged battle-tested and battle-hardened. He became a national hero and a beloved commander in the IRGC. Soleimani and the forces under his command soon became one of the instrumental players in combating terrorism in Iran's southeastern areas and in Afghanistan. But the most important chapter of his military career started when he became the chief commander of the IRGC's Quds Force in 1998. General Soleimani strongly supported the Palestinian cause. He spared no effort to strengthen the Hezbollah resistance movement in Lebanon. During the 33-day war between Israel and Lebanese resistance fighters in 2006, General Soleimani went to Lebanon to oversee the battle against the Israeli regime. The fight against the Daesh terrorist group probably marked the climax of his anti-terror endeavors. During the tough campaign against Daesh, he was often seen in battlefields in Iraq and Syria. General Soleimani was the brain behind key operations that paralyzed the monster terror group and rolled back its advances. Soleimani has long been a household name in Iran and many regional countries. His presence in the battle against terrorism gave people a sense of security. It is no doubt tough for them to deal with his loss. People in Iraq and Iran are still mourning the loss of their anti-terror icon. Soleimani's funeral processions have become a symbol of unity. Following the US assassination, regional resistance groups pledged to remain steadfast on his path. The general is no longer among us, but his martyrdom seems to have given fresh blood to the resistance front.
I'd like to welcome my guest to the program, founder of Al-Qayyim Seminary out of Qom, Mehdi Taib, and from the Islamic Human Rights Commission out of London, Reza Kazem. Welcome both of you to the program. Well, let me start it off with Mehdi in Qom. Now, the U.S. had said that it was fighting against terrorism, and yet Donald Trump admitted that Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton created Daesh. So, which is it? Does the U.S. support terrorism, or is it that the U.S. is actually the leading terrorist under the guise of fighting against it?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It's good to be with you guys again.
Good evening, Marzia.
Good evening, thanks for coming.
Well, it's known for the people of the world that the main supporter of terrorism today is the system of the United States of America and the allies of the United States. The United States today is the symbol of imperialism, and especially and specifically the people of this region, they know that. They know that they've come all the way from America to this region to take over the resources of this region, and they do anything and everything, the property or anything else, they do everything in their power to take control of the resources of this region and to divide the people of this region and conquer, and also to safeguard the existence of the of Israel. So it's a joke to come and assassinate someone who's been fighting terrorism his whole life under the name of freedom, under the name of fighting with terrorism. Someone who's known for fighting against terrorism, and the people of this region love him dearly. What the United States of America did under the administration of Trump, by the order of Trump, was not something that the people of this region nor the people of the world can accept, and they didn't accept it. Mm-hmm. You saw what happened after the assassination of General Qasem Soleimani in Iran. Not only in Iran, in Iraq, in Lebanon, in Pakistan, basically in this region, and how people express their solidarity and their love for General Qasem Soleimani all around the globe. So this joke of fighting against terrorism that Trump and his administration or presidents before him, like Obama, say, it's a lie, and people know it's a lie, and they're the main supporters of terrorism in this and all around the globe.
Okay. Well, Raza, what do you think that the U.S. wanted to accomplish by killing General Soleimani, and what have they accomplished?
I think we need to understand that there is a lot of arrogance that exists within the attitude of the United States. It feels that it can do anything and get away with it, because to a large extent, over the 20th century, one of the things that has marked it is the number of places that America has intervened, invaded, etc., etc. The previous guest talked about the imperialism and the American imperialism that existed, and that's something that it has got. What has happened here is that it has been told no. It has been stood up to, it has been fought against, the agendas have been fought against, it has been directly attacked here, it has been directly targeted in many ways, and it felt that at this point in time, in all the arrogance, and while it was Trump that made this particular decision here, we need to understand it's not about just Trump. Every president that I've read about in the United States has been repulsive, and in terms of his actions with regards to the situations that have gone on and its imperialism and so on, leave alone its own domestic policy. So we need to understand that this has been an action of arrogance, that it felt that it could do this and it could get away with it. It felt that it was there was a kind of thing. Because its agendas of promoting Daesh, ISIS in the region had failed. Its ability to be able to have the kind of influence that it wanted, not just influence, it was more than influence, the hegemony that was required by Washington in terms of complete control of the land, the resources, the minds of the people, was something that is it's incomprehensible and it's unacceptable to the United States regime to be able to get that. And with something that was embodied in Qasem Soleimani was that spirit of resisting everything that America stood for in its oppression against the people of the region. So I think And the other thing that it wanted to try and do was cement the concept of promoting division between Arabs and the old Arab-Persian thing, the Iranian-Arab thing, and trying to promote that. And it was hoping that by fomenting that kind of division within Iraqi society and within there, that they had succeeded, and therefore they would cement this by targeting. That's one aspect of it. And it singularly failed because there was such a huge reaction to this that I think no one would dare to stand up to remember Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mehdi al-Muhaddis in that region and in terms of what they'd actually achieved.
Right. Interesting what you've just said. Interesting what you've just said, Reza, because actually, turning to Mehdi, we just finished listening to a speech by Sheikh Qaisal Khazali in Iraq, and he says, as a matter of fact, one of their goals was exactly what Reza was saying, trying to divide Iranians and Iraqis. And as a matter of fact, with the assassination, with the killing of General Soleimani and Abu Mehdi al-Muhandis together, that they were actually brought together eternally, he says. Even parts of each other's bodies were buried in the other country, that it has actually cemented the unity and the brotherhood of Iranians and Iraqis. Your take?
You beautifully stated that what happened made the two nations more united. They have been planting the seeds of discord between the two nations over the last decades. They've been trying to divide the people under different concepts, nationality or race or different things. The Iranians and Persians dislike Arabs, or Arabs dislike Iranians and Persians. But what happened in this assassination, which was based on a miscalculation again from the administration of the United States, caused a unity, a stronger unity between Iranians and Iraqis, between Iranians and Lebanese, between Iranians and other nations. So right now what we have is what the leader of the Islamic Republic and other leaders of the resistance said, that the blood of Soleimani is far more dangerous than Soleimani himself. The blood of Soleimani has united the people of Iran within Iran. The blood of Soleimani has united the people of this region. The blood of Soleimani has empowered the resistance line. The blood of Soleimani is far more powerful than Soleimani himself. And let's not forget that Soleimani was just a commander, a general. Soleimani comes from a school that has been taught by the teachings of Imam Khomeini, by the true teachings of Islam. And by the assassination of one general, this path, this school, won't be stopped, and it will grow as a beautiful quote that Imam Khomeini says, that kill us, our nation will wake up, and these bloods that are on your hands will wake the people and will make our eyes open. This is the beauty of the concept of martyrdom. Qasem Soleimani was fighting ISIS, was fighting imperialism, was fighting terrorism and Zionism in this region, but he wasn't alone. You see how he predicted the existence of Daesh maybe a year or a couple of months before they attacked different countries. It wasn't Qasem Soleimani alone, it was Qasem Soleimani's team. Qasem Soleimani managed to train different people, different soldiers, just like himself. And he wasn't...
Okay, yeah. Stay with me, Mehdi. Sorry, let me get Reza back in on this discussion. But Reza, other leaders of the resistance, such as Secretary General of Hezbollah, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, and also the head of Ansarullah, Abdul Malik al-Houthi, have both stated that one of the main reasons that General Soleimani was targeted was because he not only stood against the hegemon of the United States, but also the anti-Zionist, anti-Israel stance and pro-Palestinian policy I'd like you to talk about that side of things.
I think that's absolutely clear. There's no arguing with that. That's something that was there. And I think it is, they'll do well to actually remember that when Mohsin Hujjaji was killed by ISIS in the way that he was, Qasem Soleimani promised that ISIS will be cleared and all of that region will be cleared of any kind of concept of a physical Islamic caliphate, as they'd termed it in that way. And that promise was achieved. And what we see in this particular thing, that the people of Palestine themselves have said that he is the Shaheed al-Quds, the martyr of Quds. And I think it's said for a reason. The structure, the infrastructure that Qasem Soleimani, along with Imad Mughniyeh, had actually created within Palestine in terms of the tunnels, in terms of the provisions, in terms of the arms, in terms of the training, and so on and so forth, are something that are going to last for a very long time. You cannot take away the training. You cannot take away some of those things, that lessons that have actually been learnt by the Palestinians in terms of making sure that they have the ability to resist and resist effectively in terms of an armed resistance. And I think that's something that needs to be understood, that he was someone who was out there and going into Gaza. You know, who would have thought it? Unless it had actually been said, I think most people who were actually supportive of the resistance would not necessarily have imagined that this is something that could have actually happened, who are talking from the outside. And I think we need to understand that this individual and the infrastructure that he created, that fearlessness, you know, going into the battlefield in the way that he does, there are so many clips of him being, when there is even under fire and so on and so forth, that he's there, that creates a level of prowess and a level of resistance, a level of confidence that people on the front line will have, that these people are not coming from the, you know, for example, sending troops to die, like what happens in Western establishments, that this person, the commander, is actually standing on the front line and doing what needs to be done. So even the enemies, when you look at their documentaries, are you know, amazed by what he is as an individual, regardless of whether they agree with his ideology or not. And I think that combination of spirituality and so on, and that infrastructure with regards to Palestine that had actually been created by him and nurtured and nourished over a number of years before he came out of the shadows and came out into the open, this was something that has been, you know, there's a reason why they don't like him in the British government and the American government. And I think that's something that needs to be understood, that, you know, when you stand against the imperial, you know, the Zionist colony that still exists here in that region, it's something that will be something that is going to be problematic for them.
What about that, Mehdi? Isn't dealing with what Reza just said about dealing with Zionists, because General Soleimani also, do you not think that prove that the Zionists are not invincible as they like to project themselves, nor are the Americans exceptional? Your take on that?
Well, what the Americans are trying to do is that to show a strong image to people through the power of their propaganda and Hollywood, that, okay, we're the number one in the world and no one can you know, defeat us. And Israel is also a power that no one can defeat. But the reality is, Qasem Soleimani, General Qasem Soleimani, and the leaders of the resistance, because they're dealing with the American army and Israeli army here, they knew the reality of who they are and the reality of their power. So they were accurate in their estimations, they were accurate in their information, and they knew the American army and Israeli army are very weak, and they're not what Hollywood and their propaganda is showing to people.
Okay,
so,
I'm sorry to cut you off, Mehdi, but I only have 1 minute left. I want to throw it back to Reza. Now, Reza, what all of the resistance leaders that we've heard speeches from, Yemen to Iraq to Lebanon, today, all of them saying, reiterating, that American forces must leave the region, and they're not going to accept anything but that. Your take.
I think one other point I'll quickly make before I address that particular point is regarding the role of G4S. And we've seen some of the highlights in terms of identifying that G4S played in the Iraqi airport and the way that it was actually conducted. And I think it's not just about removing the American presence, it's also about looking at the detail of some of these security companies that exist and target and making sure that they're removed from Iraqi soil and Iraqi security infrastructure, because they're the ones that are part of the problem rather than part of the solution. The other aspect in terms of the devastating vengeance that has been promised, America needs to decide what it's going to do, which way it's going to go out. You know, are they going to go back in body bags, or are they going to go back, you know, in terms of the way that they are? You know, at the moment, that devastating vengeance has been promised. The Iranians went ballistic, and they classified that as a slap. So we need to understand that when they really are going to be you know, causing problems, that there are going to be lots of issues, both within Iraq and outside of Iraq and in the region, if the Americans continue to stay. It's something that's been stated right across by all of the resistance movements, and I think that's something that's inevitable.
And on that note, so sorry, Reza, I'm so sorry, but we are straight out of time. I appreciate both of you being with us. Mehdi Taib out of Qom, from the founder of the Al-Qayyim Seminary, and Reza Kazem from the Islamic Human Rights Commission out of London. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi, signing out for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
I told Jaladi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatil Jiran, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house, many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up, we must unlock them all today.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. My name is Sheikh Zaid al-Salami. A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah al-Uzma al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. You know, what Islam emphasizes on in you acquiring, you gaining that level of rizq, that level of, you know, sustenance, and at the same time you working for it. So when we talk about having no himma at all, having no determination, being a kasool person, a lazy person, you know, that is, you know, as one hadith says, it's a source of haqara. It's a source of a person becoming degenerate. Now, we can see that, as Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli says here, that our Anbiya alayhim as-salam were people who worked, and they worked for themselves. You look at Dawood salamullahi alayhi, all the way down to Musa and Prophet Jesus salamullahi alayhi, and the common customary understanding is he was working as a carpenter, and Musa salamullahi alayhi as a shepherd, and then you come all the way down to the likes of Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alihi, who was known for him to also have been a shepherd. Then you have the likes of Amir al-Mu'mineen, peace be upon him, where he always had, you know, the shovel in his hand, and he would work continuously in his own farm, and that's where he would gain his sustenance, not only for him and his family members, but also for him to live off of, which is of course something very, very honorable. It's something very, very good and positive. You know, you're doing something for yourself. You know, if you're not living off of it, then you're also making sure that, you know, there are others who are living off of it. You know, where you wake up in the morning and you have something planned for that particular day. There's a beautiful hadith again, you know, and all of these hadiths are very interesting to read, but I'm trying to be as selective as possible to keep within a reasonable time frame. This hadith is from someone who came to Imam Sadiq, peace be upon him, and said, Ya Aba Abdullah, I don't have any skill, I don't work, I don't know how to work, and I don't even know how to do business. And Ana Muharafun Muhtajun, and I am in dire needs, I am in financial needs.
Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli, the author of the book Mafatih al-Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatih al-Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be